There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Previously on WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place.
He said, we found Sherry Crandall in the office dead this evening. She had been murdered.
And I could hear her screaming through the phone, you know, screaming and just being inconsolable. I just remember just feeling my heart pounding.
I already knew basically that someone was seen strangling her.
There was no one caught.
In the hours after Sherry Crandall was found raped and strangled inside her small office in January of 1998, the police were trying to get a handle on the investigation. Were they looking for an intruder who gained access to the Prince George's Hospital Center? Someone who worked there? Or could it have been a patient? Detectives fanned out across the 40-acre campus looking for witnesses, while other investigators tried to piece together a dreadful scene. It looked like Sherry had put up a fight. Desk drawers were pulled out and left open. Items, including a wristband with a whistle attached and one of Sherry's shoes, were scattered all over the floor. The man who found the 50-year-old nurse and administrator, Fred Reynolds, a member of the cleaning crew, tried to save her life by administering CPR. But Sherry couldn't be saved. The mother of three was pronounced dead about 30 minutes after she was found.
Nothing different happens in a murder. It's all step by step. It's secure the scene, interview the witnesses, try to locate and determine witnesses. And here we got a hospital full of people. And we know it's a male. But we still need to interview everybody that's physically possible. And everybody that was working, and we called pretty much all CID in to secure Prince George's Hospital.
That's former Prince George's County Homicide Commander Mike McQuillan.
Tons and tons of people were called in, not only that night, the next day, the day after, the day after. And what we do is, as we develop witnesses or information, we come up with to-do lists, and then we start handing those to-do lists out to investigators to go out and locate witnesses.
Now, were you the manager, or was there a sergeant overseeing the squad?
There was a couple sergeants on the scene at the time, including a sergeant in charge of the evidence section.
Were you getting calls from politicians asking you what was going on?
I didn't. But I know they were being made.
That there were people of power in the county that wanted to know what was going on.
What's going on, and what are y'all doing, and how long is it going to take to close?
As crime scene technicians worked through the night, they were handing Bernie Nelson, the lead investigator in the case, pieces of a puzzle. The crime scene had been altered by the effort to save Sherry's life, and he was trying to put it back together again.
Well, I was told already that she was found bound, and I did go down to the emergency room after seeing what I had on the scene of at her office. I did go down to the emergency room to inspect her body to see what we had in that case also.
And she had been strangled?
Yes, and manual strangulation.
Manual strangulation, yes. So it wasn't a ligature that was used?
No, there was deep bruising from hands actually being around her neck and choking her out.
And is it your belief that she was raped before she was tied up?
That's hard to say. It's very possible that she was raped prior to being tied up. We have come to some conclusion on how she was raped and what position she may have been in at that time. There are some knife wounds to her neck. They weren't fatal wounds. They were soft tissue wounds, so it did appear that the suspect held a knife to her neck, possibly while he was raping her, and then upon putting her on the floor, forcing her to the floor, choked her out until she was dead.
And when that happened, the person who did this to her actually tied her up with things he found in the office, correct?
Yes, it appears that the suspect was an opportunist. We don't think that he brought anything to the scene with the idea of raping anyone or killing anyone. We believe that this may have been a thief who may have been rummaging through her office when she may have stepped out and that she possibly walked back in on this subject, and he took that opportunity to not just steal what he could from inside her office, but also to assault her and eventually killed her.
It was in Sherry's office where police found their first important clue, a fingerprint from a cord cut off of the intercom system, a cord used to help bind Sherry. Collecting fingerprints in a case like this is a process. Evidence techs coat everything in a special powder that makes prints visible. Darren Crandall, Sherry's oldest son, remembers going to the hospital in the days after her death to help Prince George's County Police identify anything missing from his mother's office. He has vivid memories of the fingerprint dust coating everything in sight.
The first time I went there with at the request of the police department was to look and see if there's anything missing or odd. I remember walking in the hallway that goes to her office, and from knee to ceiling was fingerprint dust all the way down the whole entire wall, both sides of this hallway. Every doorknob had fingerprint dust on it. My mother's office had fingerprint dust all over everything in there, the computers, the speakers, the keyboard, the telephone receiver, all kinds of stuff. Just fingerprint dust all over everything. And I remember that hallway, just looking down that hallway and just seeing, fingerprint dust down the entire hallway, floor to ceiling. And the hallway was probably, 20 yards long, 15 yards long, and just, dark powdery fingerprint dust up and down the hallway. It felt like a crime scene. It felt like it.
Think about all the things you touch in your office each day and the number of fingerprints you leave. For police, narrowing in on the fingerprints that don't belong or don't make sense takes time. Detective Nelson says the rule is to identify something the killer likely had to touch to carry out the crime.
Well, you try to, when you go on the scene, try to assess the route that the suspect took, try to find things that may have been disturbed or could have possibly been touched by the suspect. And you just fingerprint as much as you can. You don't want to get too narrow as far as your choices go of what to process. But if you make a fingerprint hit on something, you have to be able to say that the suspect should have left that. If we know from video, if we had a video of the incident, you could see actually what the suspect touched, and you could process those areas. In this case, we didn't have a video, so we had to look at everything that was disturbed inside our office and process all of that to see if we can come up with any print. We know that there was an item in the office that the suspect had to have handled, and a fresh fingerprint was recovered from that. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't mean that it came from the suspect. It could have come from anyone that worked in the office. And that's why we went around and got fingerprints from everyone to compare and then eliminate from being this contributor of this fingerprint. That was done, and no hits were made. So we're still assuming that it may have been the suspect who handled this and left that fingerprint.
Investigators immediately put the print on file in a regional database known as RAFIS and in a federal database known as AFIS, but there were no initial hits. As the investigation continued inside Sherry's office, the medical examiner was looking for clues on Sherry's body. This is Homicide Commander Mike McQuillan.
It's all difficult, but what we try to do is go backwards. And that's one step at a time. We went so far as to put a camera in the ceiling of Sherry Crandall's office and just take pictures from the top down. from the ceiling.
When you're going through the process of investigating a case, would it have been just a normal request for a rape kit to be performed on her, whether you knew whether or not she'd been sexually assaulted or not?
Yes.
And then once you did that rape kit, how soon did you realize that she had been raped and that there may have been DNA?
Well, we obviously, the rape kit was done at the medical examiner's office. I don't remember whether there was one done prior. I don't think so. I believe it was all done up at the office of the medical examiner in Baltimore the next day. That's when the evidence was found.
And then, so you knew within 24 hours that you had DNA?
Yes.
The DNA the police have had since the day after the murder came from semen extracted from the rape kit. It was found by a DNA lab technician. The suspect's genetic footprint was then immediately loaded into the state and national DNA databanks for comparison against other DNA profiles. Eventually, lab techs would also compare it to saliva collected from hundreds of men at the hospital the night of Sherry's death. While there was no immediate match to the fingerprint or the DNA, detectives had another potential lead they were examining.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
At the end of episode one, I told you about something police have been able to keep confidential for well over two decades. A surprising piece of information that left me stunned. There had been a witness to the murder. Listen again to what I left you with at the end of episode one. It's Detective Bernie Nelson, the lead investigator in the case, describing the phone call he got at home the night Sherry was killed.
Well, I had already received a brief synopsis when they first gave me the call when I was home, that a cleaning person found her in the office, deceased, that she was finally pronounced in the emergency room, and that they may have a possible witness that we had to deal with. So I already knew basically that someone was seen strangling her when I first got to the scene, so we had to work from there.
For as long as I've been following this case, more than 19 years now, I never knew two members of the housekeeping crew had seen Sherry working in her office between 7:15 and 7:30 that night, and that a third member of the crew had walked in on the attack sometime later. Information Detective Nelson first shared with me when I sat down with him for an interview in July of 2020. In previous interviews I'd conducted with Detective Nelson in 2003 and again in 2014 for Fox 5, the TV station I was working for at the time, he kept that information to himself. What's a bit surprising about this case is that police were able to keep confidential the fact a woman told them she walked in on the attack and could give investigators a description. A description that would likely have been a major headline in the newspapers at the time or the lead story on the evening news. She told them the killer was wearing a white lab coat and had a blue stethoscope in his pocket. A piece of information reporters might describe as a bombshell. Here's what we know. The witness who walked in on the attack, Edna Brown, a 54-year-old housekeeper, told police she didn't know if the person was hurting Sherry or helping her, but she said nothing until she heard a coworker call for help over the two-way radio she carried. That's when she finally spoke up. Brown described the killer as a black male in his 40s. She said he was not wearing a hospital identification badge. Here again is Detective Nelson.
We have no idea how long the suspect may have been with the victim prior to raping her and killing her. We noted we did have someone who saw her in the cafeteria purchasing a soft drink that was found actually on her desk in her office. So we noticed she did get back to her office with that soft drink. We did have a witness who actually stated that she observed the assault taking place. She indicated that she arrived on that floor at about 7:30 that night, but she can't say for sure because she never looked at her watch. But she estimated around 7:30 she went up on the floor. She cleaned a couple of bathrooms. And she also sat down, she said, to rest for about 15 minutes is what she estimated. So we're getting closer to 8, possibly 8:30. When she heard two screams from a female, screams of someone in distress. So when she went to investigate those screams is when she came around and observed the male on his knees to the victim's side. The victim was on the floor, on her back, and this male had his hands around her neck and was choking her out. This witness indicated that she didn't know if the male may have been trying to help her or was actually assaulting her, but I'm sure that she was scared about what she was observing, and she decided to keep it to herself. She may have been in a state of shock. I don't know. We did realize that this witness had some sort of a mental disability, but she kept it to herself. She didn't say anything to anyone until after the second cleaning person, who actually was assigned to that office, found the victim, possibly already deceased.
We wanted to talk to Edna Brown because to date, no one has spoken to her about the case other than the police. The public has never heard her account of that night, but Edna Brown passed away in March of 2015. Disappointing, for sure, so I never expected to hear from Edna Brown. But in mid-December, I was stunned when I got a call from Detective Nelson with some astonishing news. He told me he had found a videotape of an interview with Edna that had been conducted in March of 1998, and he was willing to share it with me for this podcast. To say I was excited to hear what Edna had to say about what she witnessed the night Sherry was killed would be an understatement. Keep in mind, the police have never told the public about Edna Brown until now, and to actually have a tape with her words describing the killer is just surreal.
Put on my mask.
So it's a few days after Christmas, and I'm meeting up with Detective Nelson today over at the hospital. It turns out that there was an interview with a psychiatrist because the police were trying to see if they could hypnotize Edna to see if they could get more out of her. I'm excited to see Bernie. I haven't seen him since July, and I'm going to catch up with him on where he is with the investigation and get this tape from him and hear exactly, in Edna's words, what she saw that night.
Last time I was here was in July. I came over here thinking I could get into the family health center and see if I could see the layout of the office there where Sherry was killed, but because of COVID, I decided not to go inside. So this is my first time back here. Let's see if I can get around all this construction. And here's Bernie. Hey, buddy. How are you?
All right.
All right, we're all masked up. wow, this is fantastic. This is amazing.
Yeah, these are the points where the psychiatrist goes into asking her to tell me what happened. So that's where that starts, and then she makes her comment about where hospitals are supposed to be, where people save lives and not take them.
Wow. And you say she's soft-spoken, right?
Yeah, she's soft-spoken. I'm listening to it on my computer at the office.
Yeah.
I don't have speakers hooked up to it.
Yeah.
So maybe your equipment may do a better job as far as you being able to hear. I mean, you can hear.
The two of us are standing in the Sherry Crandall Memory Garden located just outside the hospital.
I knew that there was a tape that existed, but just never came across it. We have several boxes of evidence and statement forms and paperwork, and I was looking through it and came across that, and it was mixed up with VHS tapes that were with the ATM machines that we got from the hospital back in 1998. And I was ecstatic when I saw it. Unfortunately, it was VHS. We didn't have the machine, so I immediately went over to our TV studio to have them download it to a DVD so that I can watch it. And it was like hitting a jackpot, a gold mine. It was Edna talking from the grave about what took place. Even though I watched the interview live on a monitor when it occurred in real time, exciting to hear her describe what she came across and what she saw on that night.
In addition to talking about Edna, Bernie had a lot of other updates for me this day about the case. We'll get back to those later, but I want to share with you what I saw when I went home and watched the tape. Detective Nelson had it converted from VHS to DVD, and so I was able to watch it on my computer. The interview begins with Edna Brown sitting in a high-backed leather chair up against a green wall. The psychiatrist conducting the interview is sitting just to her left. There's a clock just above her head, a large, round electric clock that shows the time is 11 minutes past 6. The 54-year-old appears to be breathing heavily and tells the doctor she's nervous. She's a plus-sized woman with short black hair dressed in a colored print blouse with a blue jacket draped over her shoulders. She speaks very softly and chooses her words carefully. For the first 30 minutes, the psychiatrist asks Edna questions about her life before explaining that he would like to hypnotize her in hopes of getting details about the attack that may have been repressed. But when he asks if she would like to do it, Edna shakes her head no. He then asks her to recount what she saw on the night of January 13th, 1998. Keep in mind, some of what she says is difficult to understand due to the quality of the recording, but I'll walk you through it.
I went up on the fourth floor at Prince George's Hospital. When I got up there, it was 7:30. And I painted two bathrooms down the hallway. And I went to the desk down on the other side, down the hallway. And I heard the lady screaming twice. And I walked past the desk. I went to the down the hallway to past the fire room to that door right there. I saw the lady laying on the floor. The man's hand was around her neck. Looked like around her neck right here.
Before Edna demonstrates how the man had his hands on Sherry's neck, she said she went onto the fourth floor at around 7:30 in the evening, cleaned a few bathrooms before hearing Sherry scream twice.
I thought the man was helping her. Seemed like he wasn't helping her, he was hurting her. When I got there, I guess God stopped me in my tracks. I thought he was helping her, still he helping her, he was killing her. I didn't realize that, cause I like to be by myself, right? And when somebody stay by themselves all the time, they don't realize a heap of things going on with people, right? So I stopped there. I stood there for about 5 minutes. Then when I was going back down the hallway past the fire room, I started to pick the telephone up twice. Some of them telling me and then you better get out of there. I got out. Before I got out of there, the man had on a white lab jacket on his knees, kneeling down. The side of his face was black. That's all I saw. The lady was laying on the floor straight up there like this. And I went back in the hallway. Got through cleaning the two bathrooms. I went downstairs on page 2. There were two more people up there in that room. I didn't see them right away. He was up there cleaning. Yeah, that's all I saw. It upset me real bad when somebody paid over here and said the lady was laying on the floor with a blouse up over here, blood was coming out. That scared me. That's all I saw, and that's all I remember.
Enda Brown says she wasn't sure what she was seeing, but after about 5 minutes, a voice inside her head told her to leave the area. She told the psychiatrist the man was in a white lab jacket, on his knees, kneeling next to Sherry, and the side of his face was black. She said she first thought the man dressed in that lab jacket with the stethoscope in his pocket was helping Sherry, but realized he wasn't when she heard the call for help go out over the two-way radio. We will never know how the public or the employees at the hospital would have reacted to Edna's description of the suspect. Had it gone public at the time, it would have explained why investigators wanted DNA samples from all of the men who worked at the hospital. It now makes sense. The witness saw a man in a white lab coat and a stethoscope assaulting Sherry, suggesting the killer may have been a person with access to the hospital. But that's not what happened, and it caused a controversy that made national news. Although Detective Nelson said they believed Edna Brown's story, I've now learned they kept it to themselves because of her intellectual disability.
She was slow. We interviewed her several times. Some aspects of what she described changed in each interview, but for the most part, she described seeing a black male in his early 40s, with black hair on the side, grayish hair on top, kneeling beside her wearing a white hospital jacket, even had a blue stethoscope tucked in the pocket. She didn't see a name tag, which she normally sees on these hospital gowns. But she also described the suspect as possibly wearing gloves at the same time. We interviewed her 3 times.
How believable is her story?
I do believe that she saw something. She never deviated from hearing the woman screaming, or a lady is how she described her. She never deviated from hearing the lady screaming twice. She never deviated from seeing this male in a hospital gown kneeling beside her, choking her out. I know that the first time that she described the scene, she was indicating that the victim was actually trying to force the suspect's hands off of her neck, but the second time she indicated that she didn't see the victim's hands at all. So she deviated from that. But I still believe that she saw something, otherwise she wouldn't have said anything. It was very frustrating.
Based on Edna Brown's description, investigators then combed through hospital records to see if anyone may match the description she gave detectives. And very quickly, police came up with the names of several men they wanted to speak with, but one man really stood out.
And we presented her with a photograph of this suspect. And when she held up the photograph, instead of looking straight on to the photo like most people would, she actually turned the photo sideways, and I asked her, what are you doing? And she said, well, I saw him from the side. And I said, well, these photos don't work that way. You have to look straight on to the photograph to see if you recognize him. And she wasn't able to do that.
Did your heart sink at that point?
Yes, but to be honest with you, I wasn't surprised because we knew that we were dealing with someone who was mentally challenged. But it was deflating when she did that because I knew that we didn't have an eyewitness who can actually identify who the perpetrator was.
Were you able to eventually rule that suspect out?
Yes, we ruled that suspect out through an interview and also through DNA testing.
Shirley Montague, Sherry's secretary, who believes she was one of the last people to see Sherry alive, also described Edna as slow. I've heard this story before, that she was mentally challenged.
Uh-huh.
How challenged was she, would you say?
She wasn't... You had to tell her something like three times.
Homicide Commander Mike McQuillan also described Edna Brown using the word slow. Did you talk to her?
I did not.
So the description of what she was like only came from your investigators?
That's right.
And what did they say?
That she was slow, that it's a difficult interview, that we're not sure that she's completely sure of what she saw. I don't remember what the answer was, but one of the questions I had was, did she see Sherry earlier on in the evening? And I don't remember what that response was. I don't think she did. I think the first time she came in contact with Sherry that day was that evening when she heard some cries for help. And she came down the hall to her office and found what she found. And that was a black male with dark hair on the sides and gray hair on the top, wearing a white lab coat and a stethoscope in his pocket, in the lab coat pocket.
After the witness walked away from Sherry's office and kept what she had seen to herself, police believe approximately 30 to 45 minutes went by before Fred Reynolds, the other member of the cleaning crew, opened the door and saw Sherry unconscious on the floor.
Well, when the cleaning person found her, he immediately called for help. He knew that it was not a person who died from natural causes, per se. He could tell that this person was attacked. So he immediately called for help and started to administer CPR, I assume after verifying that she no longer had a pulse. And it wasn't long thereafter that emergency personnel from the emergency room arrived to assist in CPR and rush her down to the emergency room.
And did the doctors, were the people that arrived to give first aid, did they detect a pulse at all?
No, we have no indication that they detected any signs of life. However, this was their family member. So they wanted to exhaust any means possible in order to revive her. And I believe that she was pronounced 20 to 30 minutes after she was found in her office.
Paul Wagner here, host of WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place. If you like what you hear, we hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. Now, back to this week's episode. The Family Health Center is in the hospital's main building, in a section that normally closes at around 5 p.m. The ways to get there included a stairway, an elevator from the lobby, or you could come in through an entrance connected to the parking garage. Shirley Montague, Sherry's secretary, says it was easy to get onto the fourth floor and inside the office.
Oh, yeah.
It was easy. From where, the parking lot?
From the parking garage.
Shirley says it was also easy to get onto the fourth floor from the main entrance of the hospital.
So you just walk to the elevators and punched a button, got to the fourth floor. Either you could walk in from on the fourth floor from the parking lot.
So it was easy.
Yes.
So if it was easy to get in, it was also easy to get out. One thing Shirley didn't mention that some others have is that visitors coming from the parking garage had to walk down a long hallway in order to access the Family Health Center, which some have said made it seem remote. We don't have a floor plan to compare against what Shirley and others have told us about the layout of the fourth floor, but here's what we know. The floor's main corridor circles the building with doors leading to three ambulatory centers, a medical library, and the clinic where Sherry was the administrator. Like many medical offices, when you open the door to the Family Health Center, you immediately stepped into its waiting room. From there, doors led to examination rooms and other offices. Sherry's office was off a corridor restricted to staff. It was small, with just a desk, a few chairs, and some filing cabinets. On the desk was a computer and framed photos of her three children. There was also a fundraiser box containing candy bars. Staffers with a sweet tooth could take one and leave cash for the latest cause Sherry was collecting for. Remember earlier when I told you about a number of items that were found on the floor inside Sherry's office? One of them was a wristband with a whistle attached. Well, no one seems to know anything about it. I only noticed the whistle while looking again at crime scene photos, and I asked Sherry's daughter, Tiffany, about it. I also asked Shirley Montague, but if Sherry had begun wearing it because she was concerned for her own safety, she never mentioned it to her family or coworkers. Here's why it's intriguing. 3 weeks before Sherry was killed, there had been a burglary inside the Family Health Center. Sherry's secretary, Shirley Montague, saw a man stealing a television from the waiting room and called security. But as she waited in her office behind a locked door, she said it took them a long time to arrive. Shirley says she first heard the thief before taking a peek out of her office to see what was going on.
I was the only one there that evening. I could hear some bumping and thumping out in the hallway, so open the door. And there was this guy taking the TV off the wall. So it made me so nervous, and he said he was taking the TV off the wall because it needed to be repaired. I said, okay, and I closed the door. I knew he was stealing, but I wasn't going to say anything else. The TV was in the lobby for the patients who were waiting to be seen by the doctors to, you know, view. And so after I didn't hear any sound or any, no sound at all out there, I called security. And it took them, oh God, all 30, 40 minutes to get up there that evening.
And was that unusual for them to take that long?
I never have had to call them, so I don't know.
So you're waiting. You were afraid to go back into the waiting area? Because
I was afraid to come out of my office, but I just closed the door and sat back at the desk and called security. And it took them like, 30, 40 minutes, almost an hour to get there.
Here again is Detective Nelson.
We were aware of a number of thefts that took place in the hospital, and we were definitely made aware of that incident in which a television was stolen just a few weeks before she was murdered. We found out that the hospital had a lot of people going in and out that shouldn't have been in the hospital, homeless people, that there were some doors found in the hospital, entry doors to stairwells that had tape over the latches so that they don't completely lock. So there were a number of things that led us to believe that this could have easily been someone who came in to steal again, and it could have been the same person who stole the television before. Since you're successful, why not look for something else that you could take? So we looked at that, and as a matter of fact, I have the email that she sent sitting in front of me, in which Sherry Crandall actually almost predicted her demise in this email.
You have it right there?
Yes. I can actually read.
Yeah, read it. Read it for me.
Well, first of all, she's complaining about the incident with Miss Montague, finding someone stealing the television, but the main thing at the end, where she's complaining about the response time from security to Miss Montague's call to security about this mail. It took about 30 minutes. But at the end of the email, Sherry Crandall said, "I am not satisfied with the response and the repeated acts of theft. I want to go on record and voice my fear that the next incident may involve a personal assault. This was too close. Please advise me of your plan to halt these felonies and your response to the above 30-minute delay to what was clearly a potentially dangerous situation." So Ms. Crandall predicted that something violent may end up happening if you cannot curtail these thefts from taking place.
How long before you learned about that email?
We received this information within a day or two.
I asked Sherry's daughter, Tiffany, what she knew about that note.
Yeah, the email is incredible. Number one, because it was so close to the time of her death. I mean, it was within a month. And because she did ask for help, and she did say, "I fear that this could lead to personal harm," and the utmost personal harm occurred. So it really is incredible that we have that piece of paper that, you know, she sent an email saying, you know, "I have an employee and they called for help, and 30 minutes go by and nobody comes. And finally, when somebody comes, there's a TV missing out of the waiting room. And there's been thefts in the back office, and it's not okay." And, you know, she copied quite a few people on the email just saying, like, I want this on, you know, everyone here on notice, and I want to go on record. I don't know if she upset people by sending that email or if it truly was just an ominous coincidence that shortly thereafter she turns up dead.
Did it go through your mind that perhaps she had angered someone there, and as extreme that is, it was sort of payback?
It did. It went through my mind. You know, I think over the years, and especially early on, we really had to rely, you know, again, remembering how young we were, on people trained to do their job. That the detectives had their, you know, their theories, their leads, their possible suspects, and that they really were doing everything in their power. And one day we might have this theory, and the next day it might be a different theory, but that they're trained and they're going to do their job. And we really put our faith in that staff.
We know pretty much everything happened in the office, but you also got to take into account what might have happened prior to going in the office. I still don't know whether she may have walked in on somebody in her office. I don't know whether someone took her into her office. I don't know whether she was in there working at her desk and somebody came in on her.
What detectives did find when they started asking more questions was a hospital building riddled with security issues. When detectives began looking around the sprawling campus, they found doors unlocked with tape covering latch bolts. They also found dummy surveillance cameras, fakes built to look like the real thing. But they also found a workable surveillance camera on the fourth floor that may have captured someone coming or going, but when police examined it, they discovered there was no tape in the recorder. It's been 23 years since Sherry's murder, and in those 23 years, neither the fingerprint nor the DNA have gotten a hit in any local or federal law enforcement database. A few words here about the killer's genetic footprint. Over the years, it's been compared repeatedly against hundreds of possible suspects without success, and when that didn't pan out, it was entered into the FBI's CODIS database to see if a match could be found in the universe of convicted criminals who have had to, by law, give up their DNA. CODIS began with a handful of states in 1994, and then with all 50 states in October of 1998. 10 months after Sherry's death. The killer's DNA has also been compared against thousands of DNA samples like blood, saliva, and hair taken from crime scenes nationwide, in which investigators are still looking for suspects. CODIS is an acronym for Combined DNA Index System, which holds DNA profiles from every DNA databank in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. It's been a remarkable tool for law enforcement, connecting suspects to crimes that otherwise may never have been solved. According to the FBI, CODIS now contains more than 14 million offender profiles and 4 million arrestee profiles. As of September 2020, CODIS has produced over 533,288 hits or matches, assisting in more than 521,562 investigations. That's over 500,000 matches in criminal cases nationwide. Yet CODIS has produced no leads in the murder of Sherry Crandall. By now you've heard quite a lot about the crime and very little about Sherry. I can tell you this, she was adored by the people she supervised and cherished by her three children. Tiffany, who was in her early 20s when her mom was killed, described her this way. She said, "My mom grew up in rural Maine, where she was the captain of the cheerleaders, active in student government, and played basketball. She had soft, brown curls and rare green eyes. She loved to sing and was in the Maine All-State Choir." Tiffany says she and her brothers fondly remember hearing their mother singing in church on Sundays. Tiffany said her personality can only be described as sparkling, a part of her distinctive character that drew people in. She had a gentle manner and an infectious laugh, always giving, even over the needs of her own. In a newsletter published by the hospital in the days after the murder, Karen O'Neill, a woman who described herself as a confidant and friend of Sherry's, had nothing but effusive praise for the supervisor everyone seemed to love. She said, "Sherry made each person feel important, wanted, needed, and good about themselves. She risked caring about every person she met. Position, status, gender, and race never mattered. She helped us laugh, cry, and gave us plenty of opportunity for personal and professional growth." Shirley Montague got to know Sherry quite well in the years they worked together in the Family Health Center. Shirley worked as Sherry's secretary and is now retired. As we sat on her back patio in the spring of 2020, I asked Shirley how she would describe her boss.
Her children were nice. She was nice. And that's it. I mean, she was there every day, 5 days a week. And I was there 5 days a week. And all of the nurses and nurses' aides were very fond of her. She was just happy. She would go to lunch with us downstairs in the cafeteria where some of the supervisors, they wouldn't do that. They would just sit supervisor, supervisor. But Sherry was different. She would mingle with her employees and enjoy the conversation that the employees were having. She loved her children. She really loved her children. Sherry loved everybody. She was just a nice person.
When I've read some of the things about her over the years, my understanding is she had a big laugh. Is that right?
Excuse me. Yes, she did. It was kind of loud, like, kind of loud. It was different. And she was happy. She seemed to be happy all the time.
And if you heard that laugh somewhere in the office, you knew something was good, right?
You could hear her way down the hall sometimes. Yes.
But Sherry had no enemies, none that investigators have been able to find. Could the killer have been the man seen stealing the TV? A burglary so brazen and easy he came back for more? Unlikely, say police. The descriptions of the two were very different. At the time of her death, Sherry was going through a divorce with her husband, John. They were not living together. Still, John Crandall rushed to the hospital with his son, Luke, the night Sherry was killed. He was interviewed by police, gave up his DNA, and was ruled out as a suspect. John Crandall passed away in 2008. Coming up in Episode 3, with no hits on the DNA or fingerprints, police begin asking hundreds of hospital workers for their DNA.
The people that we represented didn't have fear that the killer hadn't been caught. They had fear that their jobs were in danger, and they were being personally insulted.
We did have to go to the hospital to find these people, serve them with the grand jury subpoenas.
Murder in a Safe Place, Season 2 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, has been written and produced by me, Paul Wagner, and CaseJackets.com. Like what you're hearing so far? Please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. For more on the Sherry Crandall case, go to AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. Have a question you'd like to see answered in a future show? Email me at paul@WTOP.com. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight DC, Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to spotlightdc.org. You can follow us on Twitter at @AMNightmarePod and on Facebook at facebook.com/AMNightmarePod. If you know anything about the murder of Sherry Crandall, you're asked to call Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-TIPS. This podcast series would not be possible without the help of Sherry's three children, the Prince George's County Police, Shirley Montague, Detective Bernie Nelson, and Mike McQuillan. Editorial assistance from Julia Ziegler and Craig Schwab. Music for this episode is Runway 47 by Immersive Music and Flum Flum by Up North Music. Subscribe to WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place, on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.